All right, so Rhaim Tovim, everybody. Good afternoon. We want to welcome Dr. Mark Herman. He's making his debut on Torah in Motion. It's a pleasure to welcome him. Dr. Herman is assistant professor at the Department of Humanities and a member of the Kashinsky Center for Jewish Studies at York University. If I'm not mistaken, you correct me if I'm wrong, you're basically taking the position that Dr. Marty Lukshin had before he made Aliyah. He'll, of course, be giving the class tomorrow. I don't know, is that more or less correct?
I try not to think of myself as filling any
I'm sorry. I meant that as a compliment. I meant that Dr. Lukshin retired, made Aliyah, and they bring a young, nice, exciting professor. So it's really a pleasure to have you. That's why he moved to Toronto. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, held fellowships at Columbia, Harvard, and Yale Law School, and served as a rabbinic intern at KJ Kelet Yeshurun in New York City under Rabbi Lukshin, and it's a pleasure to welcome. And I guess I want to thank Mar Armachatanim from Allentown because Dr. Herman spent some time in Allentown where Armachatanim live, and they were the ones who recommended that we invite Dr. Herman to speak. And I'm sure you'll all understand why in a few minutes, and really to address a subject that I think many of us know very little about. And with that, Dr. Mark Vakasha, it's all yours.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman, and to Shira for coordinating for the invitation and the coordination. I'm going to try and share my screen, which we had success at earlier. So let's see if it works. Get some nods from whoever has their cameras on.
Working, yeah. It's working fine. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, great. So Shira asked me to tell everybody that I would try to be, I'm open to people jumping in, having questions in the middle. I'm then more than happy to do that. I do have the chat open. And so I will try to keep my eye on that as well, although I can only look at so many screens at once. And I'll do my best. And if people, obviously, it would be great if people could keep their cameras on. If at all, I understand some people cannot, but if you can, that would certainly make for a more lively and participatory discussion as best as possible. So, again, thank you to Rabbi Kelman for the invitation. To Shira, I've heard a lot of good things about Torah in Motion, and I'm honored to be here today. Okay, so when Rabbi Kelman and I were discussing the options for this series, I think that there were a number of topics that came up, and what was exciting, perhaps arguably, about the Gaonic topic is that, as Rabbi Kelman said, it's really a very, very important period in Jewish history. But it's arguably the only one that perhaps might need such a series, right? I think most sort of the Torah in Motion audience, as far as I understand, probably knows the basic contours of maybe later medieval Jewish history, some modern period, certainly, maybe if looking at the biblical period, rabbinic period, right? If we look at a lot of those sort of periods, we might not need such a broad introductory class as we would when discussing the Gaonim of Babel, of Baghdad and Iraq, in the 7th to 10th centuries, right? But as the Talmud tells us, Hakol Talui B'Mazal, right? Everything is sort of dependent on luck or astrology, let's say. And we certain periods just happen to succeed and get more attention from interested parties later in the day. And for lots of reasons, some of which we'll be able to discuss today, some of which we won't, the Gaonim did not quite succeed all the time in, the contemporary Jewish consciousness in the same way figures like Maimonides or Ramban or Rashi, the Balei Tosfot, maybe have done. And for that reason, I guess we have two basic goals in mind, and they are should be pretty easy to remember because they are the title of this this series. The first is sort of discuss who the Gaonim were, who were these individuals, what were their academies like, how did they, where did they live, when did they live, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, and second, why do they matter? So what? You know, there's a lot of periods of Jewish history. What was the contribution of the Gaonim in particular? And what did they tell us about Jewish history? So before we even get into some of those basic, really big questions that we're going to talk about, I think it's probably safe to assume that the Gaonim are not entirely obscure. There are some Gaonic writings, of course, that I'm sure some or all of you will have heard of some or all of these works, right? Just to name a few, right? One of them is the first major work of Jewish systematic theology, right? Sadi Gaon's Book of Beliefs and Opinions, as here's the translation. This translation was done by Samuel Rosenblatt in the first part of the 20th century. It's still sort of the It's the only, as far as I know, the only full-length English translation done from the Judeo-Arabic, the original Arabic language, right? A very important and influential work, and we'll talk more about that next week. But there's also, people might be familiar with works like Halachot Gedolot, right? This major legal compendium, very influential, certainly among later Jews, particularly in Ashkenaz and elsewhere. Probably this time of year is when the Halachot Gedolot gets the most attention for the author's famous or infamous position about Sfirat HaOmer, right? Not for now, right? But this is certainly a very important, influential work from the Gaonic period, although we'll talk about exactly its relationship to the Gaonim, hopefully towards the end of today's class. And just another example that people may have heard of is the Igeret of Shir HaGaon, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks at greater length. But this is the, translated as the epistle, the letter of Shir HaGaon, written towards the end of the 10th century. This very important statement of rabbinic history and Gaonic history that, let's say, influenced thinking about the rabbis, that is the rabbis of the Talmud and the Mishnah, up until the 21st century, very important statement of rabbinic history. So certainly there are works that are familiar from the Gaonic period, not entirely obscure, but these are sort of a hodgepodge, and certainly not, doesn't give us the full sweep of Gaonic activity intellectually, communally, or otherwise. And also, if you are a denizen of the Beit Midrash, you may be familiar with this very, very important collection of Gaonic writings, incomplete, as you can see here. It only goes up to about half of the, covering about half of the Babylonian Talmud. This is the Otzer HaGaonim by Binyamin Menashe Levin, who was a student of Rav Kook, died in 1944. And in keeping with certainly some of Rav Kook's ideas and other ideas that were in circulation in the first part of the 20th century, right? Levin took upon himself to try and recover as best as possible at Gaonic literature. This included Gaonic citations of the Gaonim from later Rishonim, as well as newly published Gaonic writings, some of which from the Cairo Geniza and other manuscript findings that we'll talk about a little bit. Levin, this is a massive work, monumental accomplishment, has not been completed, only been taken now, and as we speak, Professor Robert Brody, who we will talk about, or at least encounter a lot of his writings the rest of today, is, and his sort of circle of students and colleagues have taken upon themselves to complete this work to cover the rest of the Babylonian Talmud. But this is a massive index of sort of every time Gaonim talk about any passage or discussion in the Babylonian Talmud. The Otzer Gaonim is a very, very useful work, but it's also a work that requires a little bit of initiation and guidance to understand fully. And I would counsel anyone who has started whoever opens this work to really look at the footnotes to think about how Levin worked. Really, he's really collating Gaonic sources and also a lot of non-Gaonic sources, but anything sort of pre-Maimonides in the Islamic world as much as possible that he could get together. So this is another perhaps set of writings. Obviously, Otzer HaGaonim is something later assembled, but it's reflective of the Gaonic world. So the goal then in today's class, and then in this series as a whole, is the following. This is a four-part series, right? Today we're going to talk about sort of the basics, who the Gaonim were, what they did, where they lived, et cetera, et cetera. The sort of, you know, who, what, where, when, why of historical data. And then I've sort of chosen three topics with covering four different figures who are representative not of the Gaonic period as a whole, but only of the second half or the latter period of Gaonic history. That is Sa'adya Gaon, who we already mentioned a little bit, Shrira and his son Haya, who we talked about a little bit as well. And finally, Shmuel ben Chafni, who is a figure who is more obscure, but hopefully that will come to an end on May 31st. A very important and interesting Gaonic figure. But these figures are all towards the end of the Gaonic period. And that is the reason we're focusing on these individuals, is because we can't really say a lot about so many previous, so many Gaonic figures prior to the 8th or the 9th or 10th, early 10th century. That is, Sa'adya really inaugurated a new stage in Gaonic history, invigorating the Gaonic institutions and Gaonic Baghdad intellectually and otherwise. The earlier figures are somewhat more obscure, with the exception of maybe Natronai Gaon and some others. But basically, I would say the list is very, very short of pre-Sa'adya figures who we could offer an entire class on. So the topic of the structure of these lectures really reflects the data and sort of, and probably also to a large extent the contributions of at least individuals in the Gaonic period as well. So all right, that's our big broad introduction. The first thing that what we have to do next is think about who the Gaonim were and what they did and where they lived and when that might have happened. So obviously before we figure out where they lived and when they lived, let's just talk about the title Gaon, right? If I were to ask most people today, right, the term Gaon refers to sort of any Talmudic genius. People might think of the Gaon Mivilna, the Gra, who was a major Torah figure in the 18th century. People might use this term for other rabbinic luminaries in the 19th and 20th century, right? And that is in keeping with this idea that the Gaon means, brilliant or excellent or, maybe very smart person, right? But the title, the formal title Gaon is actually, for our period, needs to be used much more narrowly, not for any rabbinic figure of the 10th or 11th centuries, not even for any rabbinic figure in Baghdad in this period, but really for just the head of the Gaonic academies themselves. And here you see, and we'll do a lot, hopefully some nice pretty pictures today and in coming weeks, a manuscript of a responsum of a question posed to Shmuel Gaon. And here you see the phrase, Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, right? This question, then we'll read this in a second, was posed to Shmuel in his capacity as the head of the yeshiva of Gaon Yaakov. That is the pride of Jacob, right? Therefore, the title of the yeshiva is Gaon Yaakov, and he is the Gaon, that is the head of that institution. So let's just read this, respond to him together, and we will get a little bit of a sense of what is going on here. These kind of questions preserve a lot of information that we will sort of milk to the best of our ability. So I know probably not a lot of people have read manuscripts together, but this is actually a fairly easy one to read, and I will translate as we go. So starting at the very beginning of the first line, you will notice that the Aleph and the Lamed are often smushed together in what academics like to call a ligature, but we could just call it two smushed letters. But the question begins, Misha'ala she'ela, right? The question was asked, Milfanenu, Mishar ha'yeshiva, Shel Gola, right? The question was asked at the gate or the entrance to the academy of the exile. Mi beitin hagadol shel adonenu shvira rosh yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. So the question was asked of the high court. This is not just any high court, but this is taking on the title beitin hagadol that might be familiar in rabbinic descriptions of the Sanhedrin. That is, the Gaonim saw themselves and carried themselves as the leaders of the Jewish people intellectually and religiously. Adonenu Shrira Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. And that's the highlighted phrase here. Chamud Adonenu Chananya Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, right? The beloved of, meaning probably descendant of, and son in this case, of the previous or a previous Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov. And then so this question was asked of Shrira, right? And then the question continues. Uba Avor. Ki hashoel katva belashon Yishmaeli, and since the questioner wrote his question in the language of Yishmael, that is Arabic, af anu tzivinu lahashiv tshuvoteha bilshon Yishmaeli, that we too have decided to answer the question in the language of the Ishmaelites, that is Arabic. And then there's a little break in the manuscript, and then the question continues about in, I'm not in Hebrew, but in Judeo-Arabic, that is in Arabic, in Hebrew letters, a language we'll talk about a little bit more towards the end. But so here we see a lot, we can get a lot from just this question, right? We got the title of Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, right? We got this idea that people are speaking in Arabic, and also that whenever the Gaonim were asked a question, they would answer in the language of the questioner, which in this case was not Hebrew, but Arabic, reflecting a lot about Gaonic Jewish society. Similarly, we look at this manuscript, it's a little bit harder to read. So I've given you the printed edition here. And here you see again, Shrira Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, another question to Shrira. Excuse me, the mentioned Shrira, this one is to his son. Hi Gaon, Haya Gaon should be properly asked, right? And you see again, and here we're just reading from the transcription from Asaf, She'elot Asher Elu Asher Sha'al Mifanin Mar Yehuda Reish Kala, blah, 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 blah. These questions were asked of the academies. And here is the here's the question that was posed. Okay, so what I wanted to get from these questions, there's a lot to be gleaned from just the questions, but it's important to see here that this title Gaon does not just mean brilliant person, does not just mean, you know, any Jew before the time of Rashi, any rabbi before Rashi, where oftentimes in informal parlance, will people refer to leaders of North African Jewry as Gaonim or other figures like that. Properly speaking, the term Gaon only refers to the head of the academies in Baghdad. Okay. So that's what we're looking for, trying to situate these individuals. So what was the world in which the Gaonim found themselves? So if we're going to zoom back a little bit in Jewish history, right, before what we like to call the Gaonic period, the world, the, not just the Jewish world, but obviously the Jewish world along with it, was really divided into two major dynasties, right? On the one hand, in the East, you had the Persian Sassanids, and in the West, you had the Byzantine Eastern Roman Christians, right? This was up until the world about the 6th century, and this was the world that produced the two Talmuds, right? That we have the Talmud of Eretz Yisrael, right? And the Talmud of Babel, right? They were produced in these competing different societies. But sort of unexpectedly, obviously, there was a major change in world events. Out of the Arabian Peninsula, rapid and stunning expansion, came the conquering Muslims, who conquered basically the entire Jewish world, with the exception of what we like to call Ashkenaz, you know, Italy north of Sicily. That is, the Jewish world, instead of being divided into two societies, right, the Persians and the Byzantines, are the, you know, who are constantly doing battle, instead now was united under one world, that is the Abbasids, who were the regnant Muslim dynasty in the 9th and 10th centuries, right? So this Jewish world was now united under one group. And here in this map, you see the major, basically every major center of the Jews in the Islamic world, as far west as the Pyrenees. And the Jewish world certainly continued well into Persia in this period, if not beyond, although that is a little bit more obscure. But the point is, for the Gaonim and for the leaders of these religious communities, right, we now had, instead of having two worlds that were divided linguistically, divided culturally, we have one much larger world that's connected through language, trade, and other forms of communication, travel, and whatnot, right? You could send letters from one end to the other. You could communicate, and this really enabled the Gaonic academies to put their fingers in a lot of pies and to reach out as broadly as possible in order to promulgate the Judaism that they advocated for. And if we zoom in a little bit on this map, right, we generally think of the world of the Gaonim. It's centered here in some cities that are probably almost definitely familiar to everyone on this Zoom. Right here is Iraq, Jordan, contemporary Israel.
Did we lose Dr. Herman? Everything's gone, eh?
We can hear you, but not him.
Okay, so it looks like he left, and so hopefully he'll come back momentarily.
Meanwhile, you can pick up where he took.
Ruth?
Saw him, and then he just stopped. His voice stopped. He
was, yeah, that was broke. that happened quite suddenly. So hopefully that's just that maybe he got kicked out of Zoom real quick for some reason, and he should, I hope, come right back.
Does he know how to get that?
Yes, he'll just log back in. And in the meantime, why don't I tell you about a class we have tomorrow with Dr. Malka Stimkovich.
So one shot deal, that's going to be several places too.
Yes, it is only a one-time class with Dr. Malka. Tomorrow is Thursday, and it'll be right after Dr. Lakshin's class. So if you're coming to Dr. Lakshin, you can just stay on.
Shira?
Yeah, very anyone? Strange, very strange. Oh, okay, good.
All right, I apologize for that.
We have
a technical problem on my end. Let me pull ourselves up. Are we back?
You are back.
All right, I have no idea what just happened, but let me...
Kapara.
Hopefully. All right, we were over here, if I remember correctly. Is this familiar to everybody?
Yes.
Great.
Please repeat.
Okay. I apologize. I hope that does not happen again, but I make no promises to any technological end. Okay. But I just want to confirm that everyone can see and et cetera. And we were here, right, in this discussion of the two centers of the Jewish world?
You had not quite started it.
Okay, great. So I will zoom back a little bit, right? I just talked about how the Jewish world was really divided, was all of a sudden united into major centers, right? And when we think of the Gaonic world, we tend to think of the Middle East, that is the two academies in Eretz Yisrael and Babel. I think I said this, I'm not sure where it was cut off. Even though there was rabbinic learning in both centers, right? Scholars today are a little more skeptical about how strong, and certainly at an earlier date before the 10th century, let's say, the academies were in Eretz Israel, right? The evidence is not super, so robust to support the idea that there were really two centers, at least before the 10th century, before the time of Sadia, maybe a little bit before that. There was clearly rabbinic learning, but they weren't as, in Eretz Israel, wasn't as robust as certainly in Baghdad and Iraq. And this sort of reconsideration that hasn't quite taken hold among scholars, but I think is quite compelling on a lot of fronts, really it helps explain the fact that we don't have a lot of literature from Eretz Yisrael, writers living in the land of Israel in this period, right? What we do have, we have Midrash, we have Piyuv, we don't have a lot of Halakha, and really the history of rabbinic learning and the history of the Jerusalem Talmud and its reception and promulgation before the turn of the millennium is convoluted and mysterious and lacking a lot of support. So for that reason, when people speak about the Gaonim, now I have tried to winnow our discussion quite significantly, right? Instead of speaking the Gaonic period or covering all rabbinic figures all across the world, certainly the Islamic world in the 10th, 11th centuries, we've now zoomed into just the heads of the academies, not just the heads of the academies in the Middle East, but really, properly speaking, the Gaonic period and the world of the Gaonim focuses on the Gaonim of Babel and most especially the Gaonim of Baghdad. Certainly, at some point in the late 9th century, you can see here on this map, they're obscured a little bit by the circles. We have these cities of Pumbedita and Sura, right? Which people may be familiar with, right? The names of the two Gaonic academies, Sura and Pumbedita, which have their roots, although they're a little bit, it's not entirely clear the link to Talmudic era institutions. And they're sitting on these two great rivers, very close to Baghdad.
Did the Babylonian Gaonim know Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi?
Hold that question. He's left the room again.
Did the Babylonian Talmud? Did the Babylonian
in the 9th century? Dates are still a little fuzzy. These are in Baghdad. It certainly attracted a lot of intellectuals and other leaders, and certainly the rabbinic elite had moved with their academies, to the capital city, as opposed to living, let's say in Lakewood, New Jersey. They moved to Washington D.C. Okay. So what
could you clarify the years, the period?
Yes, we're getting there right now. It's a good question. Okay. So oftentimes when people
losing it again.
Gershon, the Babylonian Amorim knew the Israeli Amorim. They always talk about what is happening b'ma'arav in the West. So they did have contact with them.
But there was Ula. They needed travelers to bring the information. So it was not universally known, I think.
Right, it wasn't like it is today.
Yeah. But somehow the Gaon of Curia changes. That's another thing we have to find out. Why is it that the Gaon of Curia contact with Eretz Yisrael scholars seems to be hostile rather than collaborative? And people are writing books saying what trash is coming out of Eretz Yisrael. Their halacha is no good. Their tefillah is no good. In other words, the relationship is no longer friendly and intersecting. It's more hostile. And I sort of hope we're gonna get an explanation of that from them.
All right, I'm back now. I apologize again for this. I have switched Wi-Fi networks. I think Rogers might be working on my street, which has caused me to have other problems in the past. And so I've decided to not use the. I'm just using my cell phone. Hopefully this won't be this. We won't get kicked off again. I very much apologize for this. Are people back? Can see the screen?
Yeah.
No. I don't see the screen.
No screen.
I don't see you either.
All we see is like a shot of a model of a person. Now we don't see that. Yeah, we see.
All right, I'm back again. I really hope this works. I'm very, very much apologize for this.
We can see you now.
Yeah, we see you.
I'm very sorry. I have no idea why this is happening. I'm trying my best to overcome the technological difficulties with my own limited abilities when it comes to this stuff. Okay, let's move forward, hoping this is the end of the problems. Okay, so someone asked me just now when the Gaonic period was. I mentioned that the historians like to sort of poo-poo this idea of periodization, that is to dividing history into periods, but it certainly can be helpful in some circumstances. And when thinking about the Gaonim, there's pluses and minuses to this, but let's sort of talk about when this period might have begun and when it might have ended. Here you see on the left a list of Jewish thinkers. Let's say in Hebrew, with the Gaonim sort of after the Talmudic period, before the Rishonim, the later medieval thinkers. And I just grabbed this timeline from Wikipedia, not because it's right or wrong, but because it's sort of representative, I think, of what most people probably imagine themselves. That is, sort of after the Talmud, there's this ambiguous period of Sephora'im, which we'll talk about in a second. Then we have the Gaonim, and then the Rishonim and Achronim, sort of the middle, the early ones and the late ones, if you will. Okay, so the most important source, as I mentioned, for the Gaonic period, that is how the Gaonim saw themselves and how the Gaonim sort of situated themselves in the timeline of Jewish history, is the letter of Shira Gaon, which we'll talk about more in a couple of weeks. But it is a very, very important source. Here you see one important manuscript of this text, right? B'shem Hashem, Kel Olam, right at the beginning, right? And you see the question asked of Shira was Ketzad Nichtava HaMishnah, right? How was the Mishnah written down? That's a very important word, written down. Ta'alif, a book by Moreno, Rabbeinu Shira Gaon, Hagadol, etc., etc., right? And here you have the entire question in this manuscript. And Shira's letter sheds a lot of light on how the Gaonim saw themselves and how they thought of themselves in transition and distinguishing from earlier periods in Jewish history, right? And so if you look in Shira's letter, you see a number of comments about the beginning and end of the Talmud, right? Which obviously the Talmud has to end for the Gaonim to start. Shira discusses this on more than one occasion. And so I'd like to read a couple of quotations for you so we can understand where Shira thought, and this will help us situate the Gaonim chronologically as well. So Shira discusses the beginning and the end of the Talmud, and he writes as follows, right? In this manner, Hora'ah, that is instruction, insight, rulings, authoritative rulings, was added generation after generation until Ravina. That is, the way that rabbis thought about themselves and functioned in a rabbinic capacity continued until Ravina, right? Ravina is a late, but one of the latest named figures in the Babylonian Talmud. And when she writes this Hora'ah, this unique level of instruction was discontinued. And how do we know this according to Shrier? Why do we know that Ravina is the end? So as Shmuel Yerchana saw in, was translated here as the Book of Primordial Adam, right? Bisifro, the Adam HaRishon, right? This is a mysterious book that's mentioned in the Babylonian Talmud in a couple of places. This book apparently said, Ashi and Ravina, the end of Hora'ah. Right? They're the end of instruction. Something has changed in how rabbis are supposed to work after. So therefore, Shira tells us the Talmud properly ends with these figures, Ravina and Rav Ashi, right? Sometime in the sixth, in maybe the fourth, fifth centuries, right? And after this, Shira writes, certainly, although there was no Hora'ah, there were explanations and opinions approximating to Hora'ah, right? It wasn't quite as good, but people still continued, tried their best thereafter. And those masters were called the Rabbanan Savorae. They were the Savoraim, these anonymous figures who were not quite as good as the real Talmud people, but they still contributed something. And he says that whatever had been left hanging, these rabbis, the Savoraim, made it explicit. That is, they contributed to the text of the Talmud as we have it, Shrier tells us, but they didn't quite have the same caliber of Jewish learning as some of the earlier as some of the earlier, you know, real authorities in the Talmudic history. And similarly, so now he's given us some couple names here. This is a few pages later, right? And they, these rabbinics, these Sabaraim, and also succeeding rabbis such as Rav Eina and Rav Simuna, these are figures we don't have any information who they were, but these were apparently named figures in the Sabaraic period, incorporated several opinions of in the Gemara. That is, the Sabaraim contributed to the Talmudic text that we have today, right? Shrier is telling us. And we have a tradition from the earlier authorities, that is, Shrier is saying, I've been told by my teachers, whatever it was, that the Gemara at the beginning of Ha'isha Nignet, that is the beginning of Kiddushin, which Dav Yomi will start in a week or so, right? Until with money, how do we know this? There's the whole first part of the first couple pages of the tractate Kiddushin was redacted and incorporated by the later Rabbanan and Savarai and other passages as well. So Ravina, Shrier tells us, the Sabaraim had some role in the shaping of the Talmud, even contributed several pages of discussion, maybe other discussions as well. But we don't know their names, and their learning wasn't quite as good. So according to Shrier, then, we have the Talmudic period that formally ends with Hora'ah, ending with Ravina and Rav Ashi. Then we have the Sabaraim, right? And then comes the end of that. So this is what he says. So afterwards, Rav Ashi reigned. And in his day was the end of Hora'ah and the Talmud was sealed, right? That was the end of Talmudic learning. And there were then the Rabbanan Sabarai, the Sabaraim, this in-between period. Most of them died within a few years. So according to Shrier, this is a brief period. For the earlier authorities stated thus in the Book of Remembrance of Events, we have no idea what this book is. Shrier is referring to some document that he had. In Sivan of the year 815, that is 504 of our calendar, Sama, son of Rabbanan Judah, died, and they say that he was Abbetim. So we have some sort of information about these figures in the early sixth century. And then Shrier tells, and they were years of persecution and troubles at the end of the Sasanian monarchy. And they, that is the rabbis, were unable to establish pirkei, that is public lectures, and convene the academies and conduct the customs of the Gaonate until a number of years had passed. And the rabbis of our academy came from Petit, the neighborhood of Naharda, to the city of Pira Shabur, right? So these are all places in and around Baghdad that we saw on the map earlier. But what we see from this text and the way Shrier is constructing this history, right, is that we have a certain period of Talmudic learning that continued until about the sixth century, right? And then there was what Shrier calls a brief period of Sabaraim, which is anonymous. He claims there were a lot of persecutions. And then it sounds like only after the Sabaraim ended, did the Gaonic period begin, right? Whatever that means, but there was some sort of, the most important thing here for the Gaonic self-identity is apparently their decision to no longer give shape to the Talmud. That is, the Talmud was closed by Ravina and Rav Ashi and Hora'ah, whatever that is, and the Sabaraim. And then once they stopped adding to that text, then the Gaonic period begins. So then we're talking maybe beginning of the sixth, seventh century, but these early figures, as I mentioned, are very obscure. Okay, so that's sort of the beginning of when the Gaonic period may have begun. What about the end? So this too is tied up with a lot of politics and some other interesting discussions. So here we have a passage from a work known as the Sefer HaKabbalah, the book of, that's not Kabbalah in the mystical sense, but Kabbalah in the sense of tradition, by the 12th century Andalusian author Avraham Ibn Daud. Sometimes you'll see Ibn Daud referred to as Ravad number one, to distinguish him from two Provençal figures, Ravad number two and Ravad number three. I prefer to use the name Ibn Daud just to not sort of reduce the number of times we have to say this acronym. But Ibn Daud was an older contemporary of Maimonides, an important Aristotelian philosopher, maybe the first major Jewish Aristotelian. And in addition to his interest in science and philosophy, he also wrote what today is considered an important look back on Spanish Jewish history. But in order to get to the Jews of Spain, in order to account for Jewish tradition, he needs to give an entire account of the earlier periods as well. And one of the things he's most interested in is does anyone want to volunteer to read this passage for us in English, just to have someone else talk?
I will.
Please.
Okay. When Shrira saw that his life was prolonged and that his son Rav Chai was worthy of being head of the academy, he stepped down in favor of his son. The latter was Rav Chai Gaon, Bar Rav Shrira Gaon. He spread Torah abroad throughout Jewry more than all the other Gaonim, and by his light walked those who sought Torah from east and west. After living for 99 years, he passed away on the eve of the last day of Passover in the year 1349, is that right?
Of the Seleucid era. That is what we call Minyan Shtarot.
Right, which is equivalent to 4798 or
38.
Thank you. Of the Gaonim before him, there was none like him, and he was the last of the last, the great of the last, last of the last Gaonim.
Right. So here we have Ibn Daud telling us that Chaya and Shriya were excellent thinkers, but when Chaya died, that was it. That was the end of the Gaonic period. Right. Obviously, someone writing in Al-Andalus in Jewish Spain is invested in this idea that, you know, Baghdad is no longer in charge. And this statement and others of Shrira, really, of Ibn Daud in the 12th century in Spain, tell us that Spain is putting itself on a pedestal over Baghdad. But it sort of gives a sense of the Jewish, and this is the idea. I think most people would tell you Chai Gaon was the last Gaon. Obviously, things are a little more complicated than Ibn Daud led on. And Ibn Daud even tells us tells us as much himself. So do you want it was Dr. Lancaster, do you want to read this last, the second quotation from Ibn Daud?
I'd love to read it, yes. When Sharira saw that his life was prolonged,
The next paragraph?
Oh, I'm sorry. The members of Rabbi Chai's academy appointed Hezekiah the exilarch, the grandson of David ben Zakkai, in the see of Rabbi Chai of blessed memory. He served for a term of 2 years. Then informers denounced him to the king, and the latter imprisoned him, put him in chains, tortured him grievously, and left no survivors. After Hezekiah the exilarch and head of the academy, there were no more academics or Gaonim.
Okay, so we see here an interesting story, not for now, but we see here from Ibn Daud is telling us that, you know, I said a few pages ago that Chai Gaon is the last of the Gaonim, but you know what? There were actually other figures after him. So what is going on here is that this end, quote unquote, end of the Gaonic, quote unquote, period is a lot more complicated than Ibn Daud wants to let on. And this tells us, obviously, that as with any periodization, right, the end of a period is going to be rife with politics. It's never going to end, you know, on a dime, never cleanly. It's always going to be messy, and there's always going to be gray period in between. But what's interesting, especially, is that we sort of have now the good definition of how to think about the Gaonim. Obviously, the Gaonim saw themselves as no longer contributing to the Babylonian Talmud, right, doing a different task that was different from Ravina and Rav Ashi, different than Sabaraim. And this ended at some point when the Gaonim So when Baghdad lost its prestige, even though there may have been figures even as late as the 12th century who claimed the title Gaon in Baghdad, nevertheless, sort of by the first part of the 11th century, the Jewish world at least tried to move on from Gaonic authority. Okay, so what did these Gaonim do? There's a lot to say about the Gaonic role, and I've sort of tried in the next few slides. I want to show you a few important contributions I think the Gaonim made to in their day, and we'll sort of give us a sense of maybe the second part of our question: so why the Gaonim matter and why they matter continually to this day. So here you see not a picture of the Gaon Academy, but a reconstruction of the Yeshiva of Rav Ashi, right? This is a an artistic work that's in Beit HaTzfutot in Tel Aviv, right? And what's going on here is we have these, you know, great instructors teaching 10 rows of 70 students, right? That's the Sanhedrin in the beginning of this instruction, surrounded by many, many more students, right? This idyllic picture of the academies in Baghdad, right? And this idyllic picture is not a modern artistic reconstruction, but in fact is drawn from another important source of Gaonic history, although a controversial one and something that needs to be used with caution. This story from Natan HaBavli of the 10th century. Natan HaBavli wrote this book, this history of Baghdad, the story of Baghdad, to an audience of North African Jews, trying to emphasize the greatness of the Gaonic Academy. So we have to be a little skeptical about all of his details, but some of the sources that he brings are, some of the claims that he makes do carry some weight. So one of the descriptions that he gives, which it's hard to know what to make of, if this was always the case, or just the ideal situation, right? But he tells us the following. He says there are seven, and the seven are called the heads of rows, that are seven rows. And it sometimes happens that others are greater than them in wisdom, that is, than these heads, not because they're excellent, but because they've inherited their father's ranks, right? They're not appointed it's inheritance. For if one of the heads of rows has died, left the son capable of filling his place, he is appointed. Right, so this is a very sort of a brief snippet of Natan HaBavli's description of the Gaonic academies and Gaonic learning. But what we have here is this idyllic picture that the Gaonim are teaching this massive student body that resembles as best it can the Sanhedrin. Right, and so this, we even if we can't accept all the details of Natan's account, it certainly speaks to the fact that the Gaonim did their best to transmit the Talmud, and we'll see this more in coming weeks. That's one, I think, important activity of the Gaonic period, right? Obviously, the Talmud has to get from Baghdad to the entire Jewish world. And the way that it did that, at least at first, appears to have been through the Gaonic academies one way or another. Another important element of Gaonic authority is the composition of responsa, right? The institution of writing responsa dates, as far as we can tell, religious recordings, is not from the Gaonic period, but already in the Babylonian Talmud. We have reports of responsa, but the first compilations, the first responsa at any length, really come from the Gaonic period. I mean, here you see on the right, you see a picture of one relatively lengthy document preserved in the Cairo Geniza of one Gaonic tshuva, right? But when we open these tshuvot, we do get a little bit of a sense of how the Gaonim worked. Right, and here this line is not from the picture. I apologize, I couldn't get the manuscript of this text. I looked for it; it didn't come as readily as I wanted it to. But here we have a line tucked away in one of the tshuvot of Rav Natronai Gaon, so a pre-Sadia figure, and he tells us the following in the course of a much larger discussion. So he tells us, "Mar Rav Simunai agreed with him, that is, with the previous opinion, and the reason that he did not write to you is that he was not the head; he was not the Gaon." But rather, just the Reish Kala, the term that seems to mean the head of one of those rows. That is, he was a more junior member of the academy, and he, this guy, this individual, Rav Simunai, did not write a tshuva because he was not a Gaon, which tells us that who was responsible for writing these tshuvot? The Gaonim. So the major, there may have been some input from those around him, from this Gaon, but at the end of the day, the Gaon was speaking and writing on his own behalf and on his own ultimate authority, as vested in him by dint of being the head of the institution, right? And you see similar ideas here. Does someone want to read this this rather important tshuva from Amram Bar Sheshna, another maybe 7th, 8th century figure? Someone who wants to take this for me in English?
All right, I'll take this one. Amram Great. Okay. Amram ben Sheshna, head of the academy at Mata Mechatzia, which is Surah, to all the rabbis and their students and the rest of our brothers among the Jewish people dwelling in the country of Barcelona. Accept greetings from
right, so he is writing from Iraq all the way to the other end of the Jewish world in Spain.
Accept greetings from me and from Sema ben Paltoy, the assistant dean of the academy, and from the leading sages, and from all the scholars here in the place of the great Sanhedrin, and from my colleagues who are in the place of the lesser Sanhedrin, and from the rest of the scholars, and the Tanim, and the scholars gathered here at this seminary. As for the questions that you pose before us, we have noted and read them before us in the presence of the head of the academy and the best of scholars and all the pupils. We have studied them and we have examined what was written in them, and thus we have been instructed from the heavens. But no answer.
Okay, so here we have a rather lengthy introduction to vote, right? And where that shed light on how the Gaonim sort of position themselves, right? We are representing the Sanhedrin. We've thought about these questions, not just myself, as we've studied all the issues. We're instructing you from this sort of great center of Jewish learning, right? And obviously the Jews in Barcelona and many, many other places would write to the Gaonim their questions, right? Some of the questions you can tell are rather basic, right? Amram Sheshna is credited with putting together the first Sidur, right? That's a rather, consider a rather basic question. But if you look in other Gaonic responsa, you see more advanced questions that represent serious thinking and learning from people we recognize as Talmidei Chachamim and people who would have contributions to say, maybe in the Torah discussions. But all these figures, the Gaonim claimed and put themselves forward as these authorities. So that this is an important way the Gaonim maintain their activity. And if you were to open Levin's Otzar HaGaonim, you get a real sense of how much of the Gaonic literature, certainly before Sadia, is really comprised of these responsa. Okay, so the Gaonim obviously would often send these responsa in bundles to different centers in the Jewish world. And here you see, over time, there were attempts to assemble them into coherent books, right? They would send them in groups. And then oftentimes later figures would look back and say, how do we put these things together? Here you have a document from the Cairo Geniza that is quite clearly a table of contents, right? So some of these are on all sorts of discussions, right? So I don't know if I know how to use the pointer here. Let's see if I can figure this out. So people can see this, right? So here we have Amavoi Sheino Mafulash. This is a question about Masechet Eruvin, right? Here we have Ruvain Nasa Isha Umeit, right? So someone married a wife and he died, right? Probably a financial question, maybe a question about you, et cetera, et cetera. But these are what these documents show. Obviously, this is part of a much larger collection. You could tell from the way the document is put together that this was part of a book. This in the middle, the pages folded over, right? And we have therefore at least four sides of paper and probably tied together to create a list of responsa. They were collected about the Gaonim. So the responsa would be dispersed, and later people would assemble them. Many of these people are anonymous, but some of them actually are not. And if you look here, I brought to you a passage from the Ramban that is in 13th century in Spain, writing in his famed Milchamot Hashem, one of his first commentaries on Babylonian Talmud. And he tells us the following. He says, we saw Rabbi Judah, that is Judah ben Barzilai, our Barzilloni, an important late 11th century figure in Spain. And so this Barzilloni was an expert in the words of the Gaonim, which were always on his table, and he wrote such and such a version of the Talmudic discussion. What the Ramban is hinting at here is that figures like Judah Barzilai and others of in beyond, outside, in other communities in the Jewish world would collate Gaonic writings in manuscripts like we see in front of us. And they would produce massive collections of responsa in which that would help share Gaonic insights much broadly and promulgate them and put them together. So this is another important, obviously the Gaonim didn't quite do all this work themselves, but this was an important reflection of the importance of their responsa in the promulgation of Jewish law. Right, another important contribution that the Gaonim made, and not just the Gaonim, but other people in their day, was this idea that we should start setting forward rules for adjudication. That is, in the Babylonian Talmud, right, and other rabbinic literature, it's full of debates. So the question arose, not first in the Golden period, but first probably in the Amoraic period, how does one rule in cases of dispute before other figures, right? And so what we have in the Gaonic period is the beginning of collections of rules. So some of them, some of these rules are found in the Talmud and only put together by figures in the Gaonic period, but other ones really develop in the Gaonic period after the Talmud ends. And here you see just a passage from the Seder Tanaim V'Amoraim, an early Gaonic work, right, which half of it is made up of these rules. And here you see just some list of them. And then you see also in the Halacha Gedolot, right, at the beginning and somewhere in this work, the author or the manuscripts at least include this collection called Hilchot Ketuvot Divnei Ma'arava, whatever that might be translated as. But in, again, this collection that's made its way into Halacha Gedolot is another list of rules for adjudication, right? So it's another important byproduct of the Gaonic period is these figuring out sort of how does one reach legal rulings in Talmudic discourse. And then there's one other important discussion that I would like to have. It's a little bit controversial among scholars today, but I'll try and offer some of the evidence without coming too hard down on this on either side. And that is the role of legal compendia in Gaonic works, at least prior to the period of Saadia, who we will meet next week. People may be familiar with a number of legal works and others that are compiled and claim to be associated with the Gaonic academies in one way or the other. Here's a few of them, probably the best known ones, right on the left, we have Shi'iltot Derav Achai Gaon, which is not a halachic collection, although it's read this way often, but really is a collection of drashot, a material for drashot, that's circulated, associated with Rav Achai Gaon in one way or another, although not all Shi'iltot were of Achai's, but that's for maybe a different class. We have this work known as the Halachot Psukot, an early work, and you can see the Hebrew here, but I'm going to read the Hebrew. You can see already the confusion associated with this work, right? So it's Sefer Halachot Psukot in the middle, right? So it's called the Halachot Psukot, the definitive laws, Hilchot Re'u, or maybe it's got another title, the laws of Re'u, whatever that might mean, Hamiyuchasot, which is ascribed to Talmidei Rav Yehudai Gaon, right? This is a 19th century edition, but it's ascribed to the students of Yehudai Gaon. So we already have a big question as to who authored this work and where it came from, right? Already on this title page of this 19th century edition. And finally, we have this Halachot Gedolot, which is authored by a figure named Shimon Kayara, who is a name that is basically meaningless. And what I mean by that is that we have this name associated with this author of this work. We don't know anything about this person. So, you know, it doesn't really tell us anything about this work, just describe it to somebody who wrote this work. And this work also has its own complicated history. So to what extent can these works be considered Gaonic in the formal sense that is associated with the Gaonim and the academies and not? So I already mentioned the Halachot Psukot is a little bit complicated. We'll skip over this discussion, but it is very interesting to note that this Halachot Psukot was translated in the medieval period into Arabic, again, showing you the importance of that language for Jews of this period. But let's talk about, again, what the Gaonim thought of these works and to what extent these works can be considered Gaonic in the sense of stemming from the head of the academies. And there's going to be a lot of ambiguity in the next couple of slides, just to show you how complicated this question really is. Someone want to read this tshuva that's ascribed to Palto Gaon from the 9th century?
I can do it.
Please.
And that it is written, which is preferable and praiseworthy, to delve deeply into the laws or to study halachot ketu'ot, or decided laws?
Right, so here's the question, the question there is, does the phrase halachot ketu'ot refer to a book, like a book of laws, or just to decide collections of, you know, what we would say, like halacha lama'aseh, just sort of practical law. So the question is, even in this question, we're not really sure what the question is. Is the question, is it better to study in depth or decided law? Or is it better to study in depth or this book of law? Right? Not entirely clear, but let's go on.
And we would not have asked, but for the fact that most people incline halachot ketu'ot and say, what need do we have for Talmudic dialectic?
Right. It's a question of, you know, how much people should read study Talmud. Is not a 21st century question, but a 9th century question, right? who cares about the Talmud? Give me, you know, the bottom line law. Maybe that's what we should do. So what does the Gaon tell us?
They are not acting properly, and it is forbidden to do so because they reduce the scope of Torah, as it is said, Yagdil Torah v'yadir. He will make the Torah great and glorious.
Right.
And the halachot ketu'ot were not composed for the purpose of recitation, but rather so that if someone who has studied the entire Talmud and is engaged in it is in doubt about something and does not know how to explain it, he consults them.
Okay. So this Gaon, then in the 9th century, is telling us that these halachic compendia, perhaps of a title halachic ketu'ot, perhaps just mean groups of decided law, are not what he thinks should be done, right? So it sounds like this Gaon at least does not look to works that we think of like halachot psukot, halachot gedolot, as major works of authority. And in fact, if we look at a tshuva that probably maybe was written by Rav Hai Gaon, that's preserved in the Or Zeruah, a German compendium from the 13th century, we have a similar idea. Do you want to just read this one last brief quotation?
These halachot of Mar Rav Yehudai Gaon were not seen in Babylonia in the days of Rav Yehudai, but were brought to Babylonia by prisoners about 100 years after him. I have no idea what that means.
It's a complicated phrase, but it's potentially very, very important. Okay, so this tshuva, which maybe belongs to Rav Hai Gaon, scholars are not entirely sure about that, but is clearly written at some point after the period of Hai Gaon, are reflecting on this work that we call the Halachot Psukot that I mentioned is ascribed to Yehudai Gaon. And what this author is telling us is that they were not actually written by Yehudai Gaon, but they were, and Yehudai Gaon himself didn't have any knowledge of them. Rather, they were brought to Babylonia, that is to the academies in Baghdad, much, much later, right? To put these two sources together, this responsum of Yehudai of Hai Gaon and this one of Paltoi, you get the impression that the Gaonim were not that excited about the study of applied halachic works. Instead, they were much more interested in the study of Talmudic dialectics and intensive Talmudic study, right? Which would seem to imply then that these legal compendia, if we're going to go back to this slide, maybe didn't come from the Gaonic academies themselves, right? The Gaonim have a sort of ambivalent relationship to the works such as Halachot Gedolot, Halachot Psukot. They certainly, some Gaonic sources, others do, but some Gaonic sources don't ascribe Halachot Psukot to Yehudai Gaon, all of which implies that these works are not necessarily thought of by the heads of the academies and maybe the students themselves as Gaonic in the proper formal sense. Rather, the Gaonim, instead of being interested in works of applied law, like Halachot Gedolot, were much more interested in study of Talmudic dialectics in a more focused and intensive way. So just apologies again for the interruptions. I'll turn off the screen share now. We can maybe take a peek at the chat, have some time for some questions. If we were to sort of sum up, and hopefully it answered both questions that we started with, right? The first question was, who were the Gaonim? And we talked about, you know, focused really in Baghdad, heads of the academies from about the 6th, 7th century until the end of the Gaonic period, let's say 11th century, according to some people, right? And why do they matter? I've tried to highlight some of the important aspects of early Gaonic literature, right? Emphasis on the Talmud, study of the Talmud, promulgation of the Talmud, in that discussion, writing of responsa. And then this question of, you know, their relationship to these legal compendia, which is a fraught question. I'm happy to share some resources on that. But without sort of weighing or coming down one way or another, it's important to note that the Gaonim themselves were at least ambivalent towards the study of these works and perhaps thought that instead of studying, you know, halacha l'maaseh, simple, straightforward summaries of the Talmudic discussion, one should really focus on the Talmud itself. And try his best or her best to distill and understand the Talmudic discussions as they are. So that's the Gaonim. We'll take time for one for questions in 1 second. We'll take some time for questions in a minute. In the next couple of weeks, I want to sort of focus on individual Gaonim and from the 10th and 11th centuries, and sort of talk about their contributions to Jewish literature as well. So I see there's some questions in the chat. And there may be probably some questions from the live as well. So
can you tell me where do the stamayim fit into this?
So the stamayim is another term for the saboraim. That would be the figures apparently the figures that Shuri refers to as the saboraim. That is who the stamayim apparently were. Obviously, modern scholarly descriptions of the stamayim take Shrira as a starting point, but really read that much broader and do a lot more work in the reconstruction of the Talmud than Shrira, sort of using Shrira as the beginning, but go much further in that question. The question of their role is hotly debated, and not really my expertise, other than to say that. It's an interesting question that hasn't really been definitively answered, but certainly that seems to, that all that discussion emerges really from Shira's discussion of the Saboraim.
Doesn't Halivni distinguish between the Saboraim and the Stamayim?
He might. I'm sure he does somewhere. I don't think that everyone takes Halivni on agrees Halivni on all those sort of intricate points. Particularly, I mean, my point here is to show you that it comes from Shira, and there are different ways to apply that as well. Some people sort of think it's earlier than Shira, happened for a longer period. It's a hotly discussed topic that I don't really have time to go into at the moment. But yeah, you're right to say that there are a range of positions on that question.
Hi, can I ask you a question, which really riveting. I really love this. I've actually written a bit about the subject myself. However, I noticed that in the map of Europe, you mentioned Lucca, which is where Ibn Ezra wrote his commentary, the introduction to his commentary on the Torah, including his very funny critique of Gaonim, which I'm not going to go into. So what I wanted to ask you is, because, I visited Lucca, was it really a centre of Talmud at that time? Because that would be very exciting. I hadn't realized. Or was it just on the map to show you where Rome was?
That was just on the map to show you. I think we already just put it on the map to show you where we're situated.
Oh, I see. Because Lucca was some sort of center when Ibn Ezra went there from Spain. And also Haifa even more, because I taught Ibn Ezra at the University of Haifa. And I didn't realize it was a center, But maybe that was...
Yeah, some of the figures on the map, I'm not sure exactly where the map comes from, all the details of why each city was identified.
I thought what you did was really good. Some of it was very new indeed, on the Gaon. I think it's going to be a brilliant course. Thank you so much. I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
Bye.
any further... I can try and take a look at the chat. There's a question here about the interpretation of Sof Hora'ah. Which we saw in the Talmud and in Shira's question. It's a complicated discussion as to what exactly means, whether it's authority in terms of caliber of authority or just institutional professional authority. I tried to be ambiguous about that, but I'm not sure. The last question also, there was a question about a pseudonymity in this tshuva associated with Haigaon. So I'm not sure. I think generally speaking, in those kind of passages, the question is not, is it Gaonic, but which Gaon we are referring to. I think that's generally speaking, right? In this tshuva in particular, there is other evidence outside of the Or Zeruah for its Gaonic provenance, but we're not entirely sure which Gaon authored the text. I hope that answers some of the questions in the chat. If there's any more, I'm happy to...
I actually was asking about... Well, we got this book and it says it was written by Yehudai Gaon, but he wasn't around when Yehudai Gaon was here. So what does that mean? Somebody wrote a book and put his name on it?
Wouldn't be the first time in Jewish history.
That's exactly the point.
The question of the authorship of Halachot Psukot is a rather hot debate in this very tiny corner of the academy between Professor Robert Brody and Professor Nachman Danzig. And Danzig thinks that basically the Halachot Psukot, the ascription of Halachot Psukot to Yehudai is correct, and rereads some of this evidence. And Professor Brody says, no, it's not, it shouldn't be ascribed to Yehudai. Among his, what I think is among the stronger pieces of evidence that he gives is that Yehudai, as far as we know, was a very, very conservative figure. That is, someone who didn't innovate proud, that was proud to not have innovated in his halachic positions. And first of all, he suggests that it would be surprising for such a figure to be the first Gaon than to write a work of halacha. I encourage anyone to read Danzig's 500 or 600 page book on this topic if they want to know more and make up their own mind. But that is the question, sort of how to weigh this evidence and what we should do with each of the pieces of evidence. Yeah.
How big was the Gaonic group within the total Jewish world? And the second part would be, was it just the difference in learning between a book of Halachot Sukkot and Talmud? Was that a way to keep power in their hands? Others, they don't want books that are easily accessible by the regular man. They wanted the rabbis to be interact with people when they asked halachic questions, because it really wasn't until the Jewish world was fully immersed in the Islamic world that proper codes were made. And in the Babylonian world, that was still not something that was done.
But so your first question is how big was it? Yeah. So I think your first question was how big was the Gaonic group? Do you mean the academies themselves?
The groups that were affiliated with them, because people like Salo Baron say that even in Maimonides' time, the Karaites were bigger than the Rabbinites.
So the question of my impression is that most people think that the rabbinic establishment or the rabbinicized Jews were greater demographically than Karaites, although that is a very difficult thing to measure and probably differed between time and place. That's a difficult question to answer. A more interesting and potentially much more complicated question is, what did it mean to be rabbinic in, let's say Mosul in Iraq at the time of Nachshon and Gaon, right? It's not clear, how much access people would have had to rabbinic literature and, distinctively rabbinic practices. Figuring out what is distinctively rabbinic practice itself is complicated. But it seems that demographically, I think most people think the Karaites, at least the Karaites, sometimes describe themselves as a minority. So if we can take that at face value, we should. But exactly what that meant and loyalty to the Gaonic, rabbinic Judaism was certainly complex and not a question that we have definitive answers to just yet, although something that's, I think, at the forefront of this scholarly agenda. When it comes to commitment to the Gaonim versus other rabbinic authorities, it's also a big question, something that is developing, and I have some more thoughts on it's a whole another complicated discussion. But, to what extent were the Gaonic authorities in charge, or what about other local versus other local rabbis? That also obviously changed over time and place. And then you asked also about the power of, why did the Gaonim think that you should only study, you should rule from the Talmud itself, right? So this is obviously a longstanding question in Jewish history. Some reasons that you suggested are probably correct. That is, it's probably because they wanted to, maintain rabbinic authority, maybe because they thought that the best way to think through law was through the texts themselves, not through summaries, maybe because you're never going to, you're not going to get it right unless you know the sources, all sorts of reasons that are out there. And many of them are offered, some of them are offered by the Gaonim and certainly later Rishonim themselves. But there's there's no one answer to that question. I think there's a lot of answers that are probably part of the puzzle there. Any other oral questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Rabbi Mark, so are you saying that there, even at this early date, there was a town versus gown dichotomy? Are there any?
I think that.
Are there like local rabbis at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we can't really tell in great detail, but where we can tell, it becomes significant, right? The most important center in the later part of the Gaonic period is in North Africa, in a city called Kairouan in Tunisia. Where figures like Rabbeinu Hananel, Rabbeinu Nissim functioned. And as far as we can tell, over time, the Beit Midrash and the rabbinic authority in Kairouan became more comfortable with itself and became less reliant on the Gaonim and more expert in rabbinic literature, right? So this is obvious. Kairouan is not typical because it was a major commercial hub and has a lot to say about, you know, is attracted, you know, first rate scholars in a way that other cities didn't. But as far as we can tell, as these communities grew, they sort of became more independent from Gaonic authority. This is very apparent in the Jewish community in Spain, in Al-Andalus, where Shmuel HaNagid, who was a contemporary of Haigaon, a younger contemporary of Haigaon, poet, among other many important roles that he had, is very clear that he is fighting against the Gaonic authority and sort of trying to put himself on that stand. I sort of think that he even may have flirted with the title Gaon, which would be quite audacious for him to take on himself. But I don't know if my colleagues all agree with me on that point. But yeah, I think as far as we can tell, in these where we can tell, the story is fairly clear that over time, local experts became greater authorities. But that's probably not representative of the majority Jewish experience, right? We don't have, I name Mosul because we know the Jews there. We don't know what Jewish life was like. Even in a city like Fustat in Old Cairo, where the Gniza is, at this period, it's sort of, and certainly the early part of the Golden period, it's very difficult to know what Jewish life was like there, and authorities and studying and et cetera, et cetera. And so where we know, it's interesting, but there's a lot more unknown than known here. Any other questions? Okay, so thank you very much. My email was on the slide. I closed it, but it's hermanm@yorku.ca. I look forward to seeing as many people as coming next week, where we will focus specifically on Sadia Gaon, arguably the most influential of the Gaonim, certainly in the 10th century, if not beyond. Thank you. Thank you again for hosting for Torah and Moshe.
Thanks, Dr. Herman. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Look forward to seeing you next week. Bye, everyone.